Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Welcome, folks. Happy Saturday. Hope things are going great. And today we have back, you know, Claire Lopez and Ryan Morrow. And Claire, as you know, is she's a senior fellow with the Clarion Project, senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy, a senior fellow with Gatestone. She's been involved in the Clarion Project, which is an unbelievable film on Muslim infiltration, jihad. I mean, it's something that you really need to see, well-researched and documented. I was fascinated by it. And Ryan is a national security analyst with the Clarion Project, and their website is clarionproject.org, and that will also lead you to the movie. And they've been our guests before, about a month ago. I got all sorts of emails, rave reviews, and we have them back today, and thanks a lot, guys. Thanks for joining us. Today we're going to talk about three things, basically. Number one, I'm going to have Ryan and Claire explain to you exactly what Sharia law is. I mean, you always hear Sharia this and Sharia that and Sharia whatever. But these guys know what Sharia is. And I think Claire will bring it into particularly clear focus in terms of what Sharia law means to women. And I think it'll be an eye-opener for you. And then we're going to talk about Benghazi. Because Benghazi is not only horrible in its own right, but Benghazi is symbolic, as Ryan and Claire are going to tell you, of a much deeper fracture in the government, a much deeper cancer in the government. And last but not least, we're going to devote about half the show to education. Because what happened in Benghazi, The poo-poo that Sharia law gets, and trust me, folks, when you hear these guys explain it to you, you won't be poo-pooing Sharia law. All this comes from education or lack of education. It's the act or lack of act of information. So those are the three things we're going to cover today. So let's start with Sharia law. Who wants to lead it off and tell us a little bit about what this lovely, lovely principle of law is?
Well, I'll go ahead here. Thanks, Reed. Thanks very much, and thanks for mentioning the Clarion Project, and of course, the film there is The Third Jihad.
Yeah,
and,
which is fabulous. I mean, you folks, go see the film. It doesn't take long. You will learn more in the half an hour to an hour that you spend than you have learned in 1,000 newscasts over the last 5 years, no matter what station you watch. Go ahead, Claire. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Sure, no problem. Well, Sharia actually means law, Islamic law. And in Islam, the law is a complete and codified system which encompasses every aspect of life. It not only is intended to govern the lives of all Muslims, uniquely among world belief systems, Sharia also purports to have authority over the entire world and everyone in it. So it is a very unique type of law. It is codified. It is written down. It is in books. It is codified into the legal systems of numbers of countries, Islamic countries around the world. You will hear people say that Sharia is interpreted differently and this and that. No, it is not. There is one Sharia. It is codified. It's in the books. It is applied differently in different stages of completeness, you might say, more or less completely, more or less faithfully, but it is definitely written down. And let me mention for your listeners a reference that I find very useful. that I use for myself on Islamic law, on Sharia, and it's called The Reliance of the Traveler, or Umdat al-Salik. And it is a book of Shafi law. There are different so-called schools of law, Shafi being one of them. But on the major questions, they're all in agreement. So don't get distracted by that. They're all in agreement on things like jihad, by the way, mandatory for all Muslims for all time until the world is subjugated to Islam, to Islamic law.
And right, and just explain very quickly what jihad is in Sharia.
Sure. Jihad, I mean, and this is straight out of the book of law, jihad is warfare to spread Islam. It makes no bones about it. Jihad is warfare. It is an offensive war to spread Islam.
And what I've read
that warfare can be conducted in different ways. It can be conducted violently. It can be conducted with stealth and guile. It can be conducted by writing, by speaking, or by financing, providing money to support the fighters.
And what I've read on it, basically an infidel has two choices under Sharia law, convert or die.
Well, there is a third choice. Now, for those who are called polytheists or pagans by Muslims, their choice has always been convert or die. But for those like Christians and Jews, and sometimes the Zoroastrians and even Hindus have been included in that category too, those with what is so-called a revealed scripture, you know, of course, for the Christians and the Jews, that would be the Bible, the Torah. Zoroastrians have the Avesta, and of course, the Hindus, you know, the various Rig Veda and all of that. So they were given a third choice, and that is they don't have to convert. When Muslims say there is no compulsion in religion, it's true. You do not have to convert, but you have to be subjugated to Islamic law. And here we come again to that premise that Islamic law is meant for the entire world. It's not just for Muslims.
Right, which is where you have the entire discussion about the caliphate. Ryan, tell us a little bit about what the caliphate is. We're getting a feel here for Sharia. We're getting a feel here for jihad. Now, tell us what the caliphate is.
Well, what the Islamists want to do with the Muslim Brotherhood and the people that we're talking about, what they want to do is first establish an Islamic state, which is precisely as Claire described, something that's based on Sharia, based on Islamic law. Freedom is only allowed to the extent that it does not violate Islamic law as they see it. And what the caliphate is, it's not just a single Islamic state, but it's an Islamic state across every country that has ever been ruled under an Islamic form of governance, under Sharia-based governance. So when they talk about resurrecting the caliphate, what they're talking about is not taking over just one country. They're talking about destroying Israel, taking over the entire Middle East, North Africa, retaking most of Europe, and then expanding into eventually including all of the whole world. The caliphate is viewed as a force that would be resurrected and then compete with the U.S. And other powers like China in order to be the superpower of the world and the one that dictates the terms of the globe's affairs. So that's what the caliphate is. What the Muslim Brotherhood is doing is they're trying not to use the word caliphate as much because they know how that plays in the media. So one of the things you hear the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt talking about is the United Arab States with Jerusalem as their capital. That's
right,
the caliphate.
I was just going to say, it sounds like the United Nations of Muslim.
I think that's a fair comparison.
Yeah. All right. Now, tell us, give us five really cool examples of how neat Sharia is for everybody from a man's standpoint. Right.
Well, if you criticize Islam, you are now guilty of blasphemy, and that's something that you can be killed for. If you are spreading what they feel to be indecent culture, something that promotes sin, that's another thing that you can be killed for.
Let's stop there for just a moment. Tell folks what sin is.
Sin would be under Islam. Saying anything that isn't positive about Islam. So say you're a Christian,
right,
a Jew, or an atheist, or whatever. They say they give you freedom of religion. But if you discuss your religion, you have to inevitably compare and contrast it to Islam and other religions. But the second that you do that, you are now guilty of blasphemy. So it's a very narrow definition of what freedom of religion is, and it's very important that we understand the semantics here. When they use terms like democracy, when they talk about freedom and justice, they believe that true God-approved freedom comes through Sharia law. So when you hear the Muslim Brotherhood and other major Islamist organizations saying we support freedom, or even we support elections, or we support freedom of speech, in their mind, true freedoms like that come through the constraints of Sharia.
Right, which basically renders the freedoms in our parlance, under our in our frame of mind, meaningless.
Precisely.
Right. Give us three more great examples of how this works so well for guys, and then clarify
well, under Sharia,
how it works so well for girls.
Sure. Under Sharia law, you would have to pay a special tax, the jizya, which is basically a penalty, even though they don't describe it as that, for being a non-Muslim living in a Muslim world, that we are supposed to be so grateful to live under Sharia law that we have to help finance it.
No wonder Obama likes taxes so much. I'm sorry. Just a side comment.
sure. Other offenses include having your hands cut off because if you're accused of stealing. Sex outside of marriage, obviously, is a big no-no unless they've made accommodations for that under some circumstances that I think I'll let Claire elaborate upon as a woman, because it's particularly offensive towards women how they've gotten around that, how they get around that rule with temporary marriages and things like that. So, I mean, the list could go on and on, but you're talking about whippings, you're talking about the cutting off of hands and feet, going into prison, and then even softer punishments like fines or just having your media outlets shut down because by criticizing Sharia law, you're criticizing Islam and you're criticizing God, and that can't be allowed. So there's just so much that you can go on time and time again with examples across the world, I mean, even right now.
Yeah, well, basically, although the media didn't have much to say on it, but what Morsi pulled after the election, quote-unquote the election, in Egypt, in other words, shutting down any anti-state media, any anti-Islam media, killing Coptic Christians, so on and so forth, I mean, this is an example of the imposition of Sharia law under a, quote-unquote, Islamic democracy.
Right, and they use different terms, like one of the crimes is provoking instability or disrupting social order. So they find other ways of applying Sharia law, just using more acceptable language and broad language in the law so that it gives them more freedom to apply it, and they can say, look, we have a fair criminal justice system, we have a free government, because according to our laws, they have conducted illegal activity, but they're purposely written so broadly that you can have the Sharia following judges and officials use them as they see fit.
Okay. Claire, tell us about some of the really, really good stuff in Sharia for gals.
Well, you know, a lot of the provisions in Sharia regarding women are sort of the flip side of the coin from what is permitted to men. Now, let me make a comment, first of all, that the vast majority of Sharia has nothing to do with any of this stuff that we're talking about, Jew hatred or the jizya or killing infidels. The vast, vast majority of Sharia is about things like trade, commerce, paying taxes, very mundane daily things, which is why another term for Sharia is the way or the straight path. Meaning in a desert context, the pathway to water. So to put this in perspective, most of Sharia would be completely unobjectionable to anyone, but there are these parts, and they're all integral. You can't slice and dice Sharia and say we take that, but we don't take that. It's a holistic system, so that's the problem. And as far as women go, well, what the founder of Islam, Muhammad, did for his followers, the men, is actually take sort of all the human weaknesses, you know, that are attributable to the human state, and make them virtues, sanctioned by the deity, by Allah, under Islam. In other words, if you like to raid, if you like to fight, if you like to steal things from other people, if you like to lie to your enemy in order to defeat him, if you like taking women as prisoners of war and making them your sex slaves, if you like slavery in general, taking the prisoners of war and turning them into your slaves, all of these things are codified in the Sharia. They are mandated as sanctioned by the deity, by Allah. Now, as far as women go, oh, just a sampling. And by the way, something gets into Sharia in the first place because it comes from one of a couple places, only a couple places. It either comes straight out of the Quran, which Muslims believe was revealed to Muhammad, word for word, or it comes out of the Sunnah meaning the collection of the hadiths, the sayings, the actions of Muhammad, and also his biography, the Sirat, which means the account of his life and the things he did in his life as written down by his biographers. So if something comes from those places, that's how it got into the Sharia, codified by the legal scholars of Islam. By approximately the 10th century, that process was done. It was written down. It was codified. Back to women. For men, they may have as many as four wives and as many sex slaves as they would like or can afford. And that goes for the wives as well. They have to sort of be able to afford them and presumably treat them equally. That's one of the stipulations. Men may divorce their wives simply by repeating three times, "I divorce thee, I divorce thee, I divorce thee." The same is obviously none of
the... Gee, the trial lawyers wouldn't like that.
No, well, they don't have to worry about that. You know, women can only have one husband. They may not divorce their husband so simply. Men are instructed if disobedience is merely feared from their wives, verse 434 of the Quran, men are instructed to try remonstrating with them, sleep apart from them, and finally beat them. You have another verse 223 of the Quran, which says basically that men, your wives are as a tilth unto thee. That is a field, an agricultural field. So go out unto your tilth when and how you will, essentially sanctioning marital rape. There is no concept of rape within marriage within Islamic law. There is no such thing. I mean, we could go on and on. Inheritance. Women are to inherit one half of what a male would inherit, her brother. In a court of law, a woman's word is worth half that of a man. So any place in the world that actually implements and enforces Sharia as part of the state legal code, as is done in Iran, as is done in Saudi Arabia, as is done in Sudan, other places, Taliban, Afghanistan, these laws are part of the codified system of law of the country.
Now, and if a woman is raped, she needs four male witnesses.
Four
right?
male witnesses, which some will try to say, oh, that makes it... you know, very, very, it's a tough standard to meet, you know. They would have had been going at it out in the city plaza, essentially, the town plaza, for there to be, for, you know, male witnesses. What this amounts to in the end is that if a woman cannot produce those four male witnesses, then she herself may be accused of having illicit sex outside of marriage. And that has got a lot of women put in jail, in particular in places like Pakistan and other places where this law is implemented. So when people talk about Sharia, what they need to know is that any place where Sharia actually is enforced, really enforced, as part of the country's legal code, you've got these abuses, this misogyny, and that's just talking about women. Never mind
what,
Jews.
You know, I've heard various things about clitorectomies and where does that come in?
Female genital mutilation is one of the terms used for that. It is both a cultural practice among many different places, tribes across North Africa, Middle East, and on into Southwest Asia that predate Islam, but it also is very much codified into Islamic law as well. Understand that Islamic law took many pre-existing cultural practices and codified them. And this is one of those things that got codified. In particular, back to Reliance of the Traveler, by the way, you can get it at Amazon.com very cheaply. I buy all my books used. There is a passage in there referring to circumcision, as they call it, and it is said in this book under the Shafi school of jurisprudence, it is mandatory for both men and women. Under other schools of law, such as the Maliki or the Hanafi, it is considered, quote-unquote, a courtesy to the husband.
Yeah, lovely. And so it seems that the Muslim faith, Islam, is slightly more hostile toward women than the so-called Republican war on women, hmm?
you could probably say that, yeah. Where it is enforced, where it's enforced.
And how many Muslim, what would you say, what is the percentage, would you guys say, of, should we say, strict enforcement of Sharia, and what is the percentage in terms of, you know, there's 1.2 billion Muslims, right, give or take?
5.7, about 1.6 by this point.
1.6, wow. Okay,
billion.
So 1.6 mm-hmm. billion Muslims, which is a more than a fifth of the world's population. What percentage of them practice strict Sharia? What percentage of them practice strict Sharia, you know, kind of modified? And what percentage of them practice, if there is such a thing, liberal Sharia?
Well, you know, I think we can name, you know, you go down the list of organizations like Human Rights Watch and look at the list of countries at the tops of their lists for human rights abuses, and they correlate quite closely with those Muslim nations where Sharia is strictly enforced, and that obviously would include Saudi Arabia, Iran, Sudan, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and then you descend down from there.
Yeah, of course, the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, which is run, more or less, by Sharia nations, has a whole different viewpoint. We're the devil, right?
Well, it's a very good point here. In 1990, the Organization of Islamic, it's called now Cooperation, OIC, met in Cairo and issued something called the Cairo Declaration. Many people, I think, perhaps don't know this, but the Cairo Declaration essentially took all the Muslim countries of the world out of and in abrogation of the United Nations Universal Declaration on Human Rights and essentially issued its own standards of human rights, which equate to Sharia and only to Sharia. Human rights under Islam mean Sharia and nothing but Sharia, and that's the Cairo Declaration. Today there are 57 members of head of state at the head of state level of the OIC, and they are, all of them, bound by the Cairo Declaration. They are completely outside of the bounds of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights.
I believe there's only 189 countries in the world, right?
194.
So 57 of 194 are part of this council? That's
right.
That's a scary thought.
There are 56 countries plus the Palestinians.
Yeah. Let me ask a question. Is Obama's Muslim background Sunni or Shiite?
His family is Sunni.
Ah. Oh, my. What a set of coincidences. It must just be coincidence. Ryan, you were going to say something. Pop on in.
Oh, just in discussion about what percentage of Muslims are Sharia adherent, the issue is, as Claire mentioned earlier, is that Sharia is not just the criminal justice system that we're discussing, the force of government, but it's also all of these different laws that we wouldn't be objected to, that wouldn't outrage Western sensibilities. And so most Muslims, or actually all Muslims, would say, yes, I'm Sharia adherent, but they're referring to the laws that govern their daily lives that no one would care about in the first place. And they're not referring to the criminal justice system, the form of Sharia-based governance. So it's really hard to quantify it, but if you look at the different themes of this ideology that we're trying to tackle, such as that the United States is at war with Islam, or whether you support the Muslim Brotherhood, or you believe Israel should be destroyed, what you find is that the Muslim American community definitely is much more moderate compared to what you find in Europe and elsewhere. But if you look at the polls in the Middle East and in Asia and everywhere else, we're not talking about a small minority here. We're talking about double-digit numbers. The latest poll that came out showed that 40% of Palestinians support suicide bombings. And that's after the support for suicide bombings in public opinion in Muslim countries has fallen. If you were to ask them, is killing Israeli soldiers or killing civilians through shooting, just not necessarily killing yourself, the numbers would probably be much higher. So there's all sorts of different nuances that makes it hard to read these polls, but for someone that's familiar with Sharia law like myself and Claire, we understand why it's much bigger of a threat ideologically than is commonly understood. And how do Muslims grapple with the issue of Sharia? Some of them just say that the Sharia-based governance, the type that applies to politics, is not applicable to today. Others say we just don't follow Sharia at all, they just completely cut it out. But the problem that they run into is that what school of thought do they belong to? What scholar do they reference in Islamic jurisprudence in making that claim? And they don't have that. They don't have a specific school of thought that they can point to and say, this is the school that can make the argument for us. So it's done largely unilaterally.
Let me ask one quick question. we've heard little dribs and drabs about courts in the United States ruling under Sharia or applying Sharia law. You know, there's been cases where that one guy killed his two daughters because they were blasphemous or whatever, you know, crazy reason he had. Do you guys see this as a growing trend, or is this just isolated moronic instances?
Well, I would point to a study that the Center for Security Policy conducted. In 2010, we published this, and it was a study of the use or the entry into use of Sharia at the state legislature level, and that was simply done to bound the study in some way that would make it meaningful and yet not be completely unmanageable. And it was found in our study that there were multiple, many dozens of cases in which already at the state appellate court level, that is, Sharia had been introduced in one form or another into the proceedings. It doesn't mean that every decision was rendered according to Sharia, but that Sharia was introduced in some way by the defense, by the court, the judge, into the case. So it's already very widespread in the United States. And this is what the initiative called American Laws for American Courts, or ALAC, is meant to address. And again, I'll mention our legal counsel, the Center for Security Policy, David Yerushalmi, and his colleague, Mordecai Kadar, who together conducted a very interesting study about mapping Sharia and its incidence across the United States. But David, in particular, Yerushalmi, is the author of the language for American Laws for American Courts. And that's simply bills being introduced to the state legislatures across the country that say if and when in an American court of law, any foreign law, French law, Bolivian law, South Korean law, or Sharia conflict with American law, American Constitution, or the laws of the states derived from the Constitution, American laws will prevail. Only in cases of conflict would this apply, and then American law will prevail. And, of course, that's perfectly consistent with Article 6 of our Constitution.
Just out of curiosity, where can folks go see these studies? Do you have a site for them?
Yeah, if one moment.
That's the American Public Policy Alliance, I think, right?
Yeah, American that is it. Yeah.
AmericanPublicPolicyAlliance.org.
I'm not sure exactly what their website is, but if you Google
one
it, you'll find it.
Yeah, I'll have it here for you.
But while she does that, there's one other point I would make in regards to how Islamists are trying to get Sharia into the court system. And there's a group called the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America, and they issue fatwas. They have a fatwa bank, which is authoritative religious declarations. So if you're a Muslim and you have a question on how to apply the Sharia to your life, you ask them, and they have very, very radical beliefs, but they're the ones that claim to have the authority to issue the fatwas, and that's the problem that we're up against, that they're the ones with legitimacy and with religious legitimacy that they can tout. And one of the fatwas that they released was talking about the court systems, and they commanded Muslims to enter the court system, try to become judges, and institute Sharia law using other pretenses. And that's from an American group.
Yeah, this goes right back, folks, you listeners. You need to go back about a month ago to the last show that we did with Claire and Ryan, and they give you the foundation to all of this. It's fascinating, the history of, shall we say, Muslim Islamic infiltration, and it's according to a written plan, and it's in that show. You can get a copy of the plan. It's according to a written plan, and it's how they're infiltrating the society at every level. That's one of the reasons I asked about the court system. Do you have that site?
Yeah, I've got those. I have the citations. The study done by the Center for Security Policy, Sharia Law, and American States Courts is the name of the study. The website, ShariaInAmericanCourts.com.
ShariaInAmericanCourts.com. I'm gonna take a look at that myself. Thank you.
Yeah,
now,
and then the other one, the second one for the American Laws for American Courts website is publicpolicyalliance.org. Publicpolicyalliance.org.
Super. Dynamite. Now, let's shift over to Benghazi. Actually, we're not shifting. We're simply taking one step to the left, shall we say. No pun intended. So we have a wreck going here. We have an administration, you know, and everybody is, I hope everybody is familiar with what's going on. We have an administration that basically covered up an act of terrorism by an extremist Islamic Jihad group, a branch of Al-Qaeda, told us it was a anti-Muslim video that riled everybody up. That poor guy is still in jail. It's been 8 months. We know who the perpetrators are. We have not arrested anybody. Nobody's been offed by the CIA. There's been no retribution despite promises as of the moment that there would be. And we have a very troubling deal, which I think we're going to see more and more focus on as these hearings expand, and that is there were two stand-down orders with Navy SEALs loaded on a plane, armed and ready to go. All you have to do, folks, is just listen to the testimony, the initial testimony of the three Benghazi folks, York, Hicks, and the other gentleman that testified. So I think in the end we're going to find, my opinion, I'll go out on a limb, that Mr. Obama personally gave the stand-down order. He basically said, we will do nothing to rescue these people. He left these four folks to die. He did not want a fuss or muss prior to the election, and he had a very busy day the next day in Las Vegas fundraising. What do you guys think of Benghazi as a symbol of what we talked about in the last show, which is on the rightsideradio.com, and what do you guys think about Benghazi as a symbol, shall we say, on a much larger picture than Benghazi, in terms of where this government's mind is at relative to Islam, Jihad, and Sharia?
Well, I'll start off. As I mentioned to you just prior to showtime, I think Benghazi is the place where and when U.S. foreign policy of this administration came into focus, very clearly demonstrating that it has switched sides in the jihad wars. The United States government now fights, aids, abets, supports, arms, funds, trains Al-Qaeda. And Libya is the place where that came most clearly into focus. That's the significance of Benghazi, in addition to all these other relevant points that you've just mentioned, Reed. It is the place where the United States pivoted and deliberately, knowingly gave United States taxpayer dollars and military assistance to known al-Qaeda militias, Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, Libya Shield, Ansar al-Sharia, you name it. They knew who they were at the time, and Christopher Stevens was in on it. He went there to be the U.S. liaison to the revolution in 2011 against Muammar Gaddafi, who, by the way, was actually helping to keep al-Qaeda down at the time. Don't want to defend him. He was a horrific dictator for decades and dealt with his people atrociously. But on this topic, with regard to American national security, he was keeping al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM, down. They were in his jails. We turned on him, invaded his country in order to provide aid, assistance, weapons, and support and money to al-Qaeda. That's the long and the short of it.
Yeah, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So what does this foreshadow for us? Now, you know, I happen to agree with you that this is where it came into focus, although I think that Obama and his minions, the Muslim infiltration of the White House and national security agencies, I think this has really been the policy for years. This is why Fort Hood is called workplace violence. This is why terrorism is an overseas contingency. This is why Boston was self-radicalization, whatever. But I do believe that this is functioning, even though it's functioning at the highest levels of government, I don't think most of the government, and I'm quite sure most of the population, has not bought into it. I just don't think they realize it. So what do you think the ramifications, Ryan and Claire, what do you think the ramifications of this kind of wet, dead fish in the public's face and in the rest of the government's face, because they've been asleep at the switch, what's going to happen now?
Well, I think you're going to see different portions of the caliphate be resurrected, because we view the Muslim Brotherhood as moderate, thanks to naivete, and also thanks to the influence of Muslim Brotherhood legacy groups here in the United States that act as advisors to the Obama administration, and also previously to the Bush administration and other elected officials. And so the Muslim Brotherhood is viewed as the solution to the irreconcilable wing of Islamic terrorism, al-Qaeda. They view Muslim Brotherhood as being the alternative to al-Qaeda, and so emboldening the Muslim Brotherhood and having them come to power, according to this twisted viewpoint, is actually a good thing. And that's where we have this huge problem with the administration, is when it comes down to ideology. And on the issue of Syria, the Syrian opposition is something I've studied since I was a teenager, so it's really close to my heart. And this is an incredibly sad situation, what's happening now, because the choice that we have is Bashar Assad, backed by Iran and Russia, or al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood, consisting of the so-called rebels. There was an opportunity to ally with more secular democratic elements of the Syrian rebels. They were pushed to the side, and as they were being pushed to the side, they were yelling, "Where is the United States?
Right.
If you do not support us, then the Islamic extremists are going to get control on the ground," and we didn't listen to them, and now we're paying the price for it, and so is
the Syrian
population.
I disagree with you there. We heard them. We ignored them, just as we did the Green Movement in Iran in 2009. This is all intentional. Okay, I believe that this is absolutely intentional and part of
what was happening under the Bush administration as well. It's a long story where the United States did not adequately support the more secular elements, not just in Syria, but also across the Islamic world. Muslims that stand against this type of ideology and non-Muslims that stand against it also need to be supported.
But here's the difference. Bush did it out of naivete and ignorance. Obama does it purposely.
Well, he views the Muslim Brotherhood as, like I said, the moderate alternative to the irreconcilable terrorists. There was, I think I mentioned in our last interview, where then-candidate Obama in 2008 was talking to the New York Times, and he said that the goal of his foreign policy would be to convince Hamas and Hezbollah that their violence undercuts their, quote, legitimate claims. So he views these as being primarily political actors that you can reason with, and if you explain to them that they're jeopardizing their own cause, then we can come to the table and talk like adults. it's a fundamental misunderstanding of the ideology.
Right, and their legitimate claims include Jerusalem and squeezing the Israeli state into nothingness.
That has to be what he's referring to.
Yes, it's exactly what he's referring to. Claire, what do you think? What does this forebode for the future?
Well, I look at it in from two perspectives. One is domestic and one is foreign. Ryan just laid out very ably some of the foreign ramifications. We are going to see the continued rise of Islam to power, and in particular the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood to power across what we call the MENA region, Middle East, North Africa region, likely eventually in Syria too, and perhaps elsewhere. And that bodes ill for American true national security interests, as well as the interest of our ally in the region, our primary ally. By the way, it's not Turkey, it's Israel.
Yes.
And then domestically, the way I look at this is that increasingly the Muslim Brotherhood is empowered here at home, too. And the ramifications of that we can see, for instance, in some of the recent attacks. For instance, take the Boston Marathon bombing on April the 15th. We know now that the Russian services warned the FBI years ago, at least by 2011, perhaps sooner, that the older Tsarnaev brother, Tamerlane, was becoming more pious, more devout as a Muslim. The Russians know perfectly well from 1,000-plus years of experience fighting this stuff that what that means is Tamerlane was on the road to becoming a jihadi. But because our curriculum, our training curriculum, slides, PowerPoints, presentations of all sorts throughout the United States government, in particular national security agencies like the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and the entire U.S. military, also on down through to the local law enforcement groups like sheriff's departments and police departments. All of that training has been purged, literally purged over the last couple of years, in particular through 2012, to remove any references that would link Islamic law, doctrine, scripture, as the animating ideology, the fountain of Islamic terrorism, the source of Islamic terrorism.
Right, and that's a corporate culture that comes
from the training.
That's a corporate culture that comes from the very top, and I mean Obama.
Well, it is. It absolutely is. And the fact that the FBI, receiving this information, as it were, almost in a platter from the Russians, was not able, number one, either to recognize it or know what the Russians were actually telling them, or number two, or maybe it's and number two, they were not allowed to act on that kind of information. He's becoming a devout Muslim.
Oh, listen, not only were they're not allowed to act, they closed the case while he was in Russia consorting with terrorists.
Because
that's when they closed the case.
We have no provision in U.S. law at the moment, number one, to criminalize association with the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a hostile foreign power and should be so designated, but also to open a case on somebody who's not already committed a terrorist act. He was put on a list. He was put on a watch list. Tamerlane Tsarnaev was. But that didn't stop him from traveling, and it didn't stop him ultimately from together with his brother, committing the
It certainly didn't help in his identification when the bombing occurred. I mean, come on. Anyway, look, this is a perfect segue. I mean, it's a fascinating topic. We've spent a lot of time, and I hope it gives people more foundation. But I want to go from what's been done at the federal, state, and local levels to educate or uneducate people who are supposed to be protecting us, and I want to move into the educational system, okay? So let's talk a little bit about, Ryan, let's start with you. What's going on in the schools in America?
Well, besides political correctness, which is really what opens up the door, political correctness and, I would say, moral and cultural relativism is where the door is opened to the influence of propagandists that come in and try to undermine U.S. support for Israel, Western values, and change the image of the problem that we're facing from the Islamist ideology. So that, I think, is the starting point. But how have they taken advantage of that open door? There's a few different ways. It's partially because of financing, where you have, in many cases, tens of millions of dollars going from influential Saudi princes and sheikhs going to the top schools in the country. So sometimes it's money. And Iranian fronts, identified Iranian government fronts. Part of it is through just engagement, where you have identified U.S. Muslim Brotherhood entities just going into the classrooms, training teachers, making sure that they're sensitive according to their sensibilities. And that's one way of doing it. And sometimes there are actual partnerships between Muslim Brotherhood front organizations, official partnerships, and the schools. There's a group called the International Institute of Islamic Thought. That's a Muslim Brotherhood front organization that has official relationships with school, with several schools, about five of them in the United States. So they come at this from multiple different angles, and they present themselves as saying, we are the authorities on any class or any course related to history of the Middle East or religion or Islam. We're the ones that you have to come to. We're the authorities. And schools, teachers then buy into that, and they say, well, they're the experts, so we need to listen to them, and that's how they gain influence.
And the Common Core, everybody has heard of Common Core. The Common Core is one of the instrumentalities where they're kind of coalescing all this thought so that it permeates education from literally preschool until high school, and then, of course, you know, the colleges are already there. So what do you guys know about the Common Core link to Islamic infiltration of the educational system?
Well, why don't you go ahead and read some of those quotes that you were telling us before the show began.
That's actually a great idea. Folks, this is I'm not making this up, okay? I wish I was. To get a GED degree, this would include the 800,000 or so students that take these tests every year under Common Core. It would also include people who are homeschooled. Okay, you think you're saving your kids from homeschool. I'm going to read you a paragraph. This is an actual paragraph, and it's just one of hundreds. I've been through this stuff. Quote, this is on the GED test. Those who support sending aid to poor countries do so because poor countries often have high levels of poverty, poor educational systems, an ineffective police and judicial force, and limited public services such as health care, transportation networks, and banking systems. Gee, what do we hear here at the federal level? They believe that when living conditions are this poor, crime levels tend to be higher. Poor countries, because they have weak governments, often have areas that attract terrorist groups because no one is there to stop them from pursuing these types of activities. Thus, poor countries are often home to terrorist groups that are free to plan and carry out attacks on the rich, industrialized nations without fear of being stopped. This is, in fact, what happened on 9/11. This is not a misquote, folks. On 9/11, when terrorists from Afghanistan hijacked planes and carried out attacks on the United States. In this case, the terrorists originated in a country that had received large amounts of foreign aid from rich countries, but apparently it didn't work. And then they asked a question on the test. I did not make that up. That is actually in the Common Core that is being pushed by the United States government, along with the United Nations, throughout the educational systems on every grade level in the United States. Does that give you an idea? In that one paragraph, they hit Marxism. They hit the nastiness of banking systems. They hit the goodliness of good, strong government. They talk about class warfare, the rich, industrialized nations. And they talk about an omnipresent, strong government because that's the only thing that will keep us safe. And then, of course, they revise history by saying poor Afghanis hijack planes. Never mind that 19 were rich Saudis. So this is what's happening on an educational level. Now, what would you guys suggest? And this is the most important thing. We got about 4 or 5 minutes left. If you, first of all, do you guys have kids?
I do.
Okay. Ryan, you don't?
I do not.
Okay. Claire, let's start with you. What do you look for in the curriculum that your kids come home with that are being taught in their teachers that put you on alert, and what do you do when you find those, shall we say, scary clues?
Well, you know, for all the parents and even, you know, aunts, uncles, grandparents out there with children going through the school system, understand that the book companies, the big publishing companies, Macmillan and others, that publish school books for the classrooms, have boards of advisors attached to them. In the sciences, let's say, you know, they'll have a board of advisor of scientists who will look at the book on biology and say, yes, that's really how photosynthesis actually works. It is stated correctly. Okay, that's fine. But when it comes to the civics books, the history books, understand that the boards of advisors for the publishing companies on these topics include members of the Muslim Brotherhood. That is where some of this revisionist history and just plain old revisionist facts about the most basic things are creeping into some of the school books. So I would urge parents to be active in your school, be active in your parent-teacher organizations, and be active in looking at your children's school books and their homework. Be engaged with the kids in what they're learning in school. Encourage them to come home and tell you what they talked about in class that day, what the teacher told them, or what the discussion was about.
And when you start seeing crap like that paragraph I just read, that actual paragraph from core curriculum, then what do you do?
You got to go back to the school. First of all, you go back to the school. You go back to the school. You engage with the teacher of that class. You engage with the principal, the PTO if there is one, and if you need to go higher to the school district level, then you need to do that as well. The school board for whatever district that you happen to live in, you need to do that too.
Is there any linkage between, should we say, Islamic radicalization and unions? In other words,
not that I know.
Would a teacher's union step up and protect a teacher who is enthusiastically teaching the one paragraph I just gave you? I mean, that one paragraph kind of summed up everything. It's Marxist, it's jihadi, it's Islamic, it's unbelievable, is what it is.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, that comes out of a textbook, and the textbook comes out of wherever it comes out of, whatever company that produced that. And then you got to look at who authored the book, what boards of advisors advised the content for that book, what review did it pass before becoming accepted as the school textbook for that subject, school board for the region. I mean, it's not about the union so much. That's a whole other issue with its own set of discussion points. But in this case, I think we're looking at a lot of very ignorant educators, unfortunately, and a very active and engaged Muslim Brotherhood that is very attuned to how to get this material into the educational system.
Yeah, how to insidiously insert the thoughts and subliminal messages, which over time kind of add up to the message that they want to give.
Well, and as Ryan was saying before, it's not just the Muslim Brotherhood, but it's, you know, the entire postmodernist, value-neutral, progressivist agenda that goes back to the late 1800s, if you want to date it, that has developed to where we see it today, where every value is as good as every other value, where every culture is as valuable and provides as much good and worth to the humankind as every other, this sort of mentality. Lack of critical thinking.
Folks, about 2 weeks ago I interviewed Clint Clisby. By the way, Kent says say hello to you guys. He's huge fans of yours. I interviewed Kent Clisby on this very topic, which is PC progressivism and the books that he wrote on it. Because it's all linked. You see, the fracture that's made under PC progressivism by Marxist ideology opens society up to Islamic insidious insertion. The two work together. Now, you know, I think if we could track forward 1,000 years, maybe not even 1,000, maybe 100 or 200, in the end, Marxists and Islamics will be enemies. But right now, they have a common enemy. It's capitalism. And they're working in concert. And don't think they are not. Would you guys agree with that?
Sure, I think you can see the very strong similarities in Marxist rhetoric and Islamic radical rhetoric when it comes to capitalism and their propaganda points of the military-industrial complex running the world, of the Zionists owning the banks and controlling the world that way. It's
This one paragraph out of a 50-paragraph test hit every point of that. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
All right, Ryan, what would you do? We're gonna wrap up. You got 30 seconds. We're going to let you wrap up the show. You don't have kids.
I don't have kids, but I do have recommendations.
Exactly. Go.
And the recommendations would be set up a screening of the Third Jihad at your church, your synagogue, your school, if it's possible. Anywhere that you think would be possible, just reach out to us at clarionproject.org and set up a screening so that people can not just hear our words, but they need to be able to see it with their own eyes. And this is a very powerful tool to do so. And sign up for our newsletter, our biweekly newsletter at clarionproject.org as well, so you can educate yourself and keep up to date.
That's super. And spread the word, too, guys. You know, it's
Absolutely.
Not just you, it's not just your family. This is a shoulder-to-shoulder battle we have here. But we have to understand the battle, we have to understand that we have the battle, and we have to understand the enemy on the other side of the battle if we're going to win the damn war. It's just that simple. Folks, it's been absolutely terrific having you on again. Once again, we are on with Ryan Maurer. He's the National Security Analyst at the ClarionProject.org, and Claire Lopez, former CIA operative also, senior fellow at the Clarion Project, senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, and a senior fellow at the Gatestone. That's quite a mouthful, Claire. And ClarionProject.org is a place for you guys to go to get this information, along with you can go to the archives and you can listen to the sites that Claire gave you to get some of these studies, which you should get and you should pass on. Folks, this is Reed Lance Rosenthal, folks, on the Right Side Radio. KGAB AM 650 on your dial. I think I forgot to say this up front. Uh-oh, I'm in trouble. 650 and the Town Square Network, serving the Intermountain West. Hello, Montana and Idaho. I guess it's goodbye, Montana, Idaho, Nebraska, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico and Colorado, and Easy 101 in Colorado Springs, serving southern Colorado and northern New Mexico, and of course the Monster Denver 780 AM. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal. Have a great week. Think about this. Visit those websites. Look at the school curriculum. Get involved in what your child is being taught. Bye now.
For more information about Reed and his work, please go to ontherightsideradio.com. There you can also click to purchase the first two volumes of his number one best-selling historical Western series, Threads West, An American Saga, and Maps of Fate. And now the first volume of his new nonfiction series, Land for Love and Money, is available everywhere, or go to landforloveandmoney.com. That's Land for Love and Money. We'd also like to remind you that if you've missed any shows, you can go to the show archives on Reed's OnTheRightSideRadio.com webpage. We look forward to seeing you again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal, On the Right Side.